we welcome in our friend, author Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
What's up, Kimball?
Oh, wait, no, I shouldn't introduce you as Colin. You're the guy who does the stairs every day, as they say in Boston.
I was, to those two city employees, one of them missing a few teeth in the front, but still, there it was, street recognition for my stair-climbing prowess.
And I sensed in that exchange an element of grudging respect from them.
Oh, I think it was definitely, if it was like Disney World, and I was becostumed, and they had an autograph book on them, I could have been Pluto the Pup doing my signature for these guys. It's a low bar in my world, but it was one of the more exciting things in a positive direction in the past couple of years. Excitement.
And congratulations, too, on extending that long streak, another week without alcohol for you. And again, that's a battle that anybody who has dealt with that fights every day, but it's good to recognize those accomplishments.
Yeah, I don't know if it's that for me. That makes it sound like, I'm going to be that guy who can say, I could take a drink right now, Kimball, and be fine, because it wasn't something of that nature. It's just a change I had to make. But I was thinking today, actually, that if I did drink as much as I had been drinking with everything that I am dealing with stress-wise, I am pretty certain I would be dead by now on the old heart front, because you get into that zone where the heart attack becomes a possibility. So at the same time, I was also thinking it is a miracle, really, almost, that I don't drink, considering everything. I really sometimes wonder, I've done it for a long time now, what did I say, 348 weeks, and I think to myself, wow, how do you do that considering all that's going on? But I guess I think about what would happen if I didn't cue to this particular path.
Next week, we'll actually be talking about the things that you do drink.
I drink a lot. I can make drinking, imbibing of beverages, and reasons for drinking those beverages mighty interesting, Kimbo. Someone be like, oh, this guy, usually he's pretty good. I'm not tuning in next week. Tune in for the imbibing talk. You'll love it. And I bet you I can get you listeners to drink stuff you don't drink, feel good about yourself, and get all excited. Now I sound like Suzanne Summers doing an infomercial, but tune in. You'll stick it.
A little teaser for next week. But up first, this week, we're going to talk about some great and sometimes seldom heard live rock performances, starting with The Who, a recording from Fillmore West in 1968, even with a brief introduction by Bill Graham to kick it off.
From August 15th, and there are Who Fillmore East and West recordings out there from 68 and 69. The Fillmore East from the spring 68 has been released commercially a few years ago. And the gig from the day before, so August 14th at the Fillmore West, has circulated on bootleg. This is a brand new discovery, though, and it just goes to show you that there's always stuff popping up, coming out, becoming accessible. And it's a Who set that if you're into the band, you're going to just rejoice over what they're doing. You get this rare version of Daddy Rolling Stone. The harmonies are impeccable. And we're in that period of the Who's career where they're a pop art band, they're a pop band, and they're a heavy metal act. And I can't think of anyone else who had those three things going at the same time, kind of, sort of, the small bases, maybe, but not to the extent that the Who did. Keith Moon is in excellent form. I was thinking about a friend of mine had made a comment years ago online. I'm sure he wouldn't remember it, about how the Kinks were more intelligent and clever and idiosyncratic than the Who. And I just think that's really the other way around. They listen to something like Substitute. Especially from this gig, it's a fine performance. You can't have a rock and roll song that's a lot more clever, or much more clever, than Substitute. I'm not old, I'm just backdated. It's just one witticism after another. Pete Townshend was so young when he wrote it, and to be that fully formed as a writer, really emphasizing that idea as a writer at that age. So the sound is more than passable. You don't lose anything with the harmonies. Get all of Keith Moon's fills. You get a long version of Magic Bus. It's just kind of a dream come true sort of set that's popped up.
And as great as they were with their studio albums, you hear in this recording just the power of what they were like at that point in their career as a live group.
The Who, I don't think it would be, you could easily make the argument that they are the best live band in the history of rock and roll. And I would say that if there is one band that gets the most votes for that, whatever that percentage would be, 30%, it would be The Who. I think that's how people look at them. They were so dynamic in the live medium, and they had different phases within that live medium because they're really morphing. So here we have this amalgamation of those three styles that I mentioned in 1968. That's building to Tommy, and they're weird in that good way right now that we've talked about. And that's going to free them up to be really weird with Tommy. Think about like what Tommy was. Let's do a rock opera. That's weird. It's going to be about a deaf, dumb, and blind kid and this pinball champion messiah. All of it's weird, but all of it works and became this cultural touchstone. But when they were doing Young Man Blues in 1969 and 1970, it's a long ways away from the closer to Mose Allison version of Young Man Blues that they're doing here at the Fillmore in 1968. So you get these, it's like the Dead, the Grateful Dead in 1972 are very different from the Grateful Dead in 1970, who are very different from the Grateful Dead, again, live, in 1968. Hell, they're different from 68 to 69. So I like that kind of range growth. It's not like, okay, we're better now than we were before, but you still have a progression. And I think that's what the best artists do. The Who are just 3-4 top band of all time. And so I was really happy to have discovered this tape.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. From there to audio-wise, not the best recording. I think it was an audience recording, but musically, something else from 1964, The Animals in Paris, and it was just stunning to me to hear how fully formed as a blues vocalist Eric Burdon was at that time.
Eric Burdon is interesting as a singer because you know him for his phrasing, and yet he would struggle with when to come in on time if you listen to their live performances. So sometimes he had great timing, other times for a different sort of skill set, he didn't. And he sings at this, so it's December 15th, 1964 in Paris, and you mentioned the fidelity, and Eric Burdon kind of shouts his way over the scrum, the noise, the distortion. This was actually something that went out on the radio, to give you an idea. Mm. So this would have been, the way jazz, for instance, in the States, and Charlie Parker would play at some Boston club, and it would go out over the radio, but it was in a much more controlled environment of people sitting at tables and not even really clapping, and the music was able to proceed thusly. Whereas here you have all these screaming Parisian teeny boppers and this raucous rhythm and blues band doing their thing over the top of them. But Eric Burdon, his singing, he's much more shouty, I would say, than he was at other times. For instance, if you compare this concluding version of House of the Rising Sun with the version that he did on the Ed Sullivan Show, Ed Sullivan Show, it's a lot different. On the Ed Sullivan Show, he's in control of his voice the entire time. And at the end of that song for that TV performance, it's strange. I like it. He actually applauds for himself. He's sung so well. I've never really seen anyone do that. And here, it's a lot of shouting. But this is tour de force British rhythm and blues. You have Around and Around, which is a Chuck Berry number. You have Boom Boom, which is John Lee Hooker. And you have Roadrunner, Bo Diddley. And then House of the Rising Sun, of course. And I'm Crying, an Animals original. So that's really hardcore, bang your beer glass on the table, British rhythm and blues. And they would cut loose really more than they would in the studio, which isn't to knock their studio, but they were almost two different bands. You'd get that a lot. And the Animals certainly fit that bill.
1969 Baltimore, a terrific concert and great fidelity, I thought, on this one from the Stones, and a terrific set list, too.
So they were ramping up to their official live album. They had had one before, and it was, again, a lot of screaming teeny boppers. And that earlier live album, it doesn't have a great reputation. I think it should have a much better reputation than it does. It's very exciting, and I think it holds up well. I've always thought highly of it. But this was the attempt to do something proper, where we've gone from screaming teeny bopper audiences and 64, 65, 66, and into 67, to people who are going to be older, maybe stoned, sitting there listening, maybe sitting on the floor listening at somewhere like the Felt Forum or in Baltimore. So the Stones were trying to get this in the can, so to speak. Mick Jagger sings as well as he did on that legendary 1969 tour. And you're going to get one of these songs is the Robert Johnson cover is going to end up on Get Your Yeah Yeahs Out. But you hear something like their version here of Sympathy for the Devil. And Jagger, he improvises lyrics and bits of sound that I haven't heard him do anywhere else. So he's trying things out. He was clearly attempting to make a vocal splash on the record. And you get this solo first from Keith Richards, which is one of the best solos, I'd say, of his career. So is the Yeah Yeahs version. But it's always interesting to me, I love it, when a rhythm guitarist plays guitar solos, because it really shouldn't work in a way. It's not what they do. They keep the rhythm. So it's going to be a highly rhythmically inflected solo. And then there's a bridge after his solo where it's Mick Jagger vocalizing, almost like Paul McCartney does at the end of Hey Jude. And that's going to get us to Mick Taylor, the lead guitarist, for his guitar solo. And they're both equally effective guitar solos, but the one guy kind of can't play, and the other guy is the straight-up virtuoso. But those two styles work really well together, and it's just like really this perfect Stones blend. It's what they did. So if you wanted to hear them doing what they did in that live medium, this song and this overall recording, this entire concert would be sort of an ideal example.
And I think a really good high-energy version of what I think is a sometimes underappreciated Stones song, Under My Thumb.
Yeah, and Under My Thumb was a song that it would have been, it's funny how we sort of just think about time, it would have been an oldie. At the time,
right.
That's how quickly things were moving musically in the 1960s. And everyone was either doing something new or trying to do something new, and not just in competition with each other. This was such a highly competitive era. They were competing against what they had done themselves before. I love that ethos. And that's one of the reasons why the music from the 1960s, the best of it, is going to be around, like the music of Beethoven and Bach and Handel and Mozart is going to be around. And the music of right now is not going to be around. So it's coming out of that environment. So they're refashioning this song that wasn't really meant to be played live. I think of it as a studio track. And so it's very tongue-in-cheek in a way. It's satirical. The misogyny isn't played straight. It's almost played like, don't be like this. We've kind of been like this. And there's that elbow to your ribs. But yeah, it's a groove. And it's not a song that you would expect to coalesce into a groove.
Another new discovery, a recording from Denmark, 1971, with Led Zeppelin and a man, Robert Plant, at this point in their career, in absolute great voice.
Right, and there are other points in the career. Like if you listen to the band in 1980, his voice has changed a lot. I think that's strange to people. They don't really remember or think or associate Led Zeppelin with the 1980s. But they did get into the decade. And if you're getting a show from this era, so this is fairly early in the first half of 1971. What that means timeline-wise, if people don't know, is it's months before the release of what people tend to call Led Zeppelin 4. So you're getting the Led Zeppelin 4 songs. And if you listen to the beginning of Stairway to Heaven, it's a great version of Stairway to Heaven, too. People, they don't have that recognition factor where, you know how when you're listening to a show or you're at a show and people recognize like the first few notes of something and they go bonkers.
Right.
It happens like with Radiohead, or it did happen with them when they would bring out Creep, and people wouldn't know exactly what it was at first. It would take three or four notes and then there'd be that explosion. That's what would happen with Stairway to Heaven as Stairway to Heaven became known. And obviously Led Zeppelin 4 came out, and really a lot of those shows in 1972, there's the Stairway to Heaven explosion moment. Here, there's the milling about moment. Something is slow. They're not rocking hard. And Stairway to Heaven is one of those songs that I think has come unnecessarily down in the world. It is a song, and I was listening to this a couple times today, it is, it's just so aphoristically infused. There's so many things, so many lines in this song of wisdom that can actually inform your life. And then you have this guitar solo that tells a story. I think it's one of the great guitar solos in the history of the instrument, really. And so you didn't know what you're necessarily going to get live, but you have this building, climaxing guitar solo, and then John Bonham is dropping all of these bombs, as Robert Plant is dropping all of these aphorisms, and it just coalesces into something with a perfect arc. Like, a story has an arc. Stairway to Heaven isn't a story, but it has a sonic arc, and it's just very, it hits you the way you want to be hit.
Also brings back memories for me, and I'm sure probably generations of others. It seemed that forever it was the last dance at every high school dance, and if you were an awkward 16, 17 year old guy, you had to make some decisions there because of the tempo changes, and you were in for a while, so you better have some skills.
Yeah, you were in for 7 minutes and 55 seconds, and I remember that, too. And you know what? It's interesting that you bring that up. I remember being at middle school dances, and there were certain things that would come on, and Back in Black by AC/DC, or during my era when it was time to, well, it was time to rock with Pour Some Sugar on Me, but it was also time to feel the hurt with Love Bites, Kimball.
Oh,
but
yeah.
When the Zeppelin songs would come on, like Black Dog, and it's a great version of it at this Denmark show, it felt like such bad assery. Do you know what I mean? It felt like you weren't allowed to listen to it. It's like musical porn. It felt like you were crossing over into some post-childhood world, and you weren't going to get to stay there, but you were having this brave, exciting glimpse behind the curtain. It just sounded unlike anything sounded, and it sounded raw and dirty, and
oh, yeah,
grown up, and but not juvenile.
No, and you'd hear those Jimmy Page solos and Black Dog, and you'd be looking over your shoulder like, are the chaperones watching this?
Yeah, the riffage of the song, and in a sense, it's a throwback. It's antiphonal. It's a call and response between voice and instrumentation,
right.
Call and response with itself, really. But you can go back to Field Hollers, and it's the same musical format. The one side says this, the other side says that. So they just converted it into this English heavy metal. But there's this echo in Robert Plant's voice. It's almost like he's off mic, that he's not singing directly into the microphone. And you get that mysterious effect that you have with the Elvis Sunsides. When you listen to Elvis's voice on Mystery Train back in the mid-50s, it sounds like he's singing from a different dimension.
Oh, yeah. Otherworldly.
Embodied. Yeah. It's not like just how rockabilly was becoming or what country had been. It was almost like, okay, we're the band, and the singer's dead, but we have a hookup with him in the other world, and he's going to pipe some of his vocals, and we're going to just mix that in with what we're doing. So it was mysterious, and it was jo- Joseph Conrad going down the river. That's what Zeppelin was. And you know what? This particular recording is not a soundboard, this Denmark recording. And I feel that the distance, it's not really boomy, but there's some distance between you and the sound. And it approximates that vocal effect, but in an overall sonic picture. So I like it like this. I don't need the soundboard for this. It's perfectly listenable if you're not accustomed to bootlegs or anything like that. But it's just one of those Zeppelin gigs that's among the best that they ever did, or at least going by the recording.
And so, along those same lines, someone on on YouTube posed the question, and I'll throw it out to you. Was 71 Zeppelin's best year?
Zeppelin was a band where, in part because of the way that Robert Plant sang, which you alluded to earlier, it wasn't just that he changed over the years. He did. But it could be different from night to night when you were putting your voice through some of the things that he was putting his voice through. It's not a knock on him. It's, for instance, like the Beatles. They wouldn't do Money and Twist and Shout that often at the same concert, where they only were doing Money through 63. But when you hear them in Sweden on October 24th of that year, and you get both Twist and Shout and Money, or the same goes with Liverpool at the Empire Theater on December 7th of that year, and you get both, it's a treat, because it was a lot of strain on the voice. If you listen to the 64 Beatles shows when they start with Twist and Shout, it's a truncated version because they're only going to be up there for a half hour, but you can't just be destroying your voice in the first cut if you were John Lennon. So the years all have something. It's not just the years themselves. It's sort of the tours within the years. This was, like I said, before Led Zeppelin IV came out. So I would say that this is particularly exciting to me because you have a band working to win over an audience with new material. Yeah, you have amazing material. But I love that kind of hunger in the approach and in the sound. I think it's discernible. So I would gravitate towards something like this. But really, 69, 70, 71, out on the West Coast in 72, you can't go wrong with any of that. But one time we talked about a show from Minnesota in 75. That's another one. But they wouldn't be as consistent, I would say, come 75, as they were around this spring 1971 period.
Finally, a very young Bob Dylan, live in Philadelphia in 1964, and somebody made the comment on YouTube and hit home. Imagine what it must have been like to be there hearing that and hearing some of these songs for the first time.
You see what I mean about the YouTube comments, right?
Mm. Oh, yeah. They're really a lot of very insightful, knowledgeable people.
Yeah, it's like stuff that you don't see in mainstream media. You get people who have knowledge and who have passion for what they're talking about. And they're trying to share. I guess a part of it that's important, too, is they're trying to share with other people what they think. They're thinking in terms of audience, YouTube comments and everything. But that's a huge part of writing well. And so there aren't many surviving full Dylan shows from 64. This is from October. It's before, obviously, the Halloween gig that has been officially released now from New York City. And like you said, you're getting these songs that he hadn't released on record yet, songs that he would only play. Chimes of Freedom is here, and it only gets a handful of live renditions during the 1960s. I always have loved, I think it was one of the first songs that got me into Dylan when I was 16 years old, was Girl from the North Country. Mm. It tells this story, and again, I love the blend of clarity and mystery, like the Zeppelin thing. It's like the Elvis Sun Records thing. It's someone who sounds older than they are, not because of their voice so much. It doesn't sound like an old man, but because of the subject material. And it's like we're going back in time, even though it's not actually back in time, to the 1800s. And also how he let the song come to him. There aren't really a lot of ingredients, you might say, to this song, but he's able to make it into this story and this song that works on its own. So it was always something to me that I just thought took a lot of balls to play in front of people because it's sparse in a way. And he does not care that it's sparse. He trusts the material, and the material ends up working and not being lacking at all. I just found that so exciting. That's what a master does. That's very few people in any art form over the eras.
And some of those songs, it reminds me of the conversations we've had about the Grateful Dead, that if someone told you that song had been written 100 years earlier, you might say, well, all right, that makes sense.
Hard Rains Are Gonna Fall is one of those songs where it's Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. It stands outside of time, really. It's this primordial, biblical. But he's not saddled to the Bible. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
He's not dependent on chapter and verse. He's not dependent on, like, for instance, Zelda Fitzgerald was talking about Ernest Hemingway's writing. She hated Hemingway. She hated his writing. She didn't like that her husband was this fanboy. And she slagged it off by saying, it's just so damn biblical. In its cadences, if you look at Hemingway's writing, it's like this imitation of the cadences of the Bible. Dylan, he didn't have to be like that. And then you have something such as Mr. Tambourine Man, which almost goes in the opposite direction. We think of the tambourine as this older instrument. It's someone that an instrument that you'd play if you were in the band in the Yellow Submarine animated film. And yet it's this futuristic song. It's almost this space traveler, this titular character. So he's going in both directions, and yet he's still in the place that he should be in. He's commanding sort of the past, the present, and the future in that Dickensian sense. And Dylan was a very Dickensian kind of artist. He still is in some ways.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Next week, yes, indeed, we'll talk about Colin's drinking. We'll talk hibiscus tea, black coffee, and a whole lot more next Tuesday afternoon. Looking forward to it.
Okay, sounds good.
Thanks, Colin.